All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And to all my veteran brothers and sisters, thank you for your service and welcome home. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I get to be the host today on Veterans Radio. And I've got what I think is a really exciting program for you. And we're going to be talking about Islam. And we're going to be talking about the different types of Islam and actually what Islam is. And we have an expert on in the first segment of our program. And he's going to be talking about the differences between Sunni and Shiites and all the other things that go on with Islam and the history of it a little bit. And I think it's going to be very educational for all of us. So I want you to make sure you pay attention. And then in the second half of the program, we're going to be taking a look at what's going on in the Middle East now. And our guest is going to be Bing West. And many of you who have been listening to Veterans Radio over the many years we've been on now, Bing is kind of our resident expert on politics in the Middle East. And he's going to be taking care of answering some of your questions. If you want to, you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio. The number here in Ann Arbor is 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600. And feel free to give us a call at any time. We would love to have your questions and to answer any questions or concerns that you might have or, you know, things that are going on in the world as far as the veterans community is concerned. And speaking of what's going on in the veterans world, in our local community, is that we have a fundraiser coming up this Wednesday, June 13th, between 5 and 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. And this is going to be down at Frenchie's in the sidetrack area of Ypsilanti's Depot Town, right next to the sidetrack bar and grill. Who are we going to help out this time? Well, the organization is called Warriors and Caregivers United. And they want to know if you want to help combat warriors and their caregivers, you want to dine and be entertained too, well, come on down to Frenchie's on Wednesday, January 13th between 5 and 9 p.m. This organization is designed to support our warriors that are suffering from post-traumatic stress and their caregivers. This is kind of a unique organization. Most of the organizations that we have talked to in the past on Veterans Radio that deal with post-traumatic stress are only concerned about the warriors. This organization also wants to help out with the caregivers. So we encourage you to come on down. This is sponsored by the Vietnam Veterans of America, Chapter 310. There's going to be some great auction items. Miss Michigan, Stacey Mason, our former Miss Michigan, Stacey Mason is going to be there. She's an incredible singer. What a beautiful voice this woman has. And a violinist. Great food, of course, since the sidetrack is all about their food. And half the dinner receipts, all the tips and donations will be going to help this program. So we encourage you to come on down. I'm hoping to be there. They got some great auction items to give away to raise funding for the organization Warriors and Caregivers United, Wednesday, January 13th. For more information, you can go to their website, which is wacu.org. That's Warriors and Caregivers United.org. We hope to see you there. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back with our first guest, Emil Homerin, and who's a professor at the University of Rochester in upstate New York. I'm thinking they probably got a little bit more snow than we did today. But stay tuned. We're going to find out what Islam is all about and answer your questions. We'll be right back after this message. And we're back on Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Throner, and I get to be the host today for, I think, is a very interesting episode of our program. Joining me on the line in just a second, because I have to do this great introduction here, is Emil Homerin. He's a professor of religion and the chair of the Department of Religion and Classics at the University of Rochester, where he teaches courses in Islam, classical Arabic literature, and mysticism. He has completed his PhD with honors from the University of Chicago, has lived in Egypt, Turkey, Morocco for a number of years. His publications include 6 books, Chapters on Islam and the Religious Foundations of Western Civilization and Introduction to World Religions. Whew. So, I think we've got an expert here for you, folks. And I want to encourage you to give us a call if you have any questions about Islam today. The number is 734-822-1600. So, Dr. Emil Homerin, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you.
All right. I'm just going to drop the doctor and just call you Emil. Is that all right?
That's great. Thank you, sir.
All right. So, when I was talking to you the other day, I'm asking these questions for our listeners, but they're also for my benefit as well. So can you tell me a little bit about the history of Islam and how it got started?
Sure. It really goes back to Muhammad. Let's just start with the Prophet Muhammad. He was born around 670 A.D. In Mecca, which is present-day Arabia. He was orphaned as a young boy, raised by an uncle. And he grew up a respected member of his tribe. But he was troubled by kind of social and religious concerns. This time in Arabia was a period of transition. There were tribal disputes and warfare. There was the rule by the rich. The poor were abused. And there was a lot of religious change. There were Jews there. There were Christians there, idol worshippers. And Muhammad thought deeply about this situation. And around 610, when he was 40 years old, he began to receive revelations. Now, they claim these were revelations from God, and he soon began to preach and call people to worship the one true God, the God of the Bible. During his early years, he denounced idolatry, called for economic and social justice, warned people about the powers of Satan and an awesome judgment day that would soon come. He built a community over a period of about 20 years, and this was a community of believers, and the interesting part here, it was based on belief, not blood, as the old tribal system had been. And many of the revelations that came to him later addressed concerns like diet, marriage, these matters that, you know, those of us in religion, it's who you marry and who you eat, or what you eat. Who you marry and what you eat often determines sort of your social and religious identity. He was both a prophet and a statesman, and after a period of time, he was triumphant in Mecca and really established a kingdom there in Arabia, and then he dies in 632.
And how old was he when he died?
Well, we think
approximately.
Maybe he was about 60, 65. Yeah.
Okay.
And so then after he died, they collect together his revelations. And this is what is formed the Quran, which means the recitation. And it is the major scripture of Islam. It's a book composed of 114 chapters that are arranged by length. We don't know why. The shortest, usually longest to shortest. They all are in Arabic. And it's quite different than the Bible. You know, you look at the, say, Genesis, and it starts with creation and goes through to the story of Joseph, and then it picks up with Exodus and the story of Moses. So there you have a narrative history.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you look at the Gospel, say the Gospel of Matthew, in the New Testament, it starts with the birth of Jesus and goes through with his crucifixion. The Quran doesn't work that way. It doesn't have a straight narrative like that, but rather it gives you a series of stories. The stories many of the stories we get in the Bible about Moses or Jesus or Abraham, but they don't come in that kind of narrative order. They're more about the particular lesson. And so it's probably most useful to think of the Quran in terms of its major themes. Like monotheism, there's only one God, and only one God. And then social justice, that there's the need to establish a just social order for human beings, to ward off selfishness and Satan, and to be constantly vigilant in your life, to do the right things so that when the time comes and you die and the judgment day comes, that you will go to heaven. So those are some of the kind of major themes that we see repeated quite often in the Quran.
It sounds like there's a lot of similarities between this and many of the, I guess you would say, Western religions.
Yeah, of other kind of monotheistic traditions. It's very similar in those respects. And then after Muhammad's after he dies too, and the Quran's collected, you have individuals within the community. They believe that Muhammad is the final prophet that is sent by God to reaffirm what had been declared by all the other prophets, from Adam to Abraham, Moses and Jesus, namely to believe in God, his angels, the prophets, the revelations, and the judgment day. And then to add to those themes, they created what we now call the five pillars of Islam. These are the things that every Muslim should do. One is to believe there's no God and that Muhammad is his prophet. Then there are the five daily prayers, an annual tithe that people pay on their possessions to be used for the good of others. There's the daytime fast in the month of Ramadan that we hear about. And then there's the Hajj, or the pilgrimage to Mecca, that a Muslim should do once in their lifetime, but only if they're financially and physically able. If you have debt, you shouldn't do it, because you could die and not repay your debts. Or if you're very ill, the Quran doesn't want you to go out of the way to fulfill just a ritual when that's not the purpose of it. And then there's the one last thing that is a focus oftentimes today, and that's what we call jihad. Now, this is not a pillar of Islam, but it's important. It means struggle, literally just to struggle with your selfishness, for instance. And originally, Muhammad undertook jihad in a response to Arab pagans who persecuted Muslims, Christians, and Jews, for that matter, too. And in many verses, the Quran calls Muslims to defend their faith. So initially, it was quite defensive. And God promises his forgiveness to those who may die in the cause. Later on, in the 20th century, and especially today, some militants, like the leaders of ISIS or Osama bin Laden, have regarded jihad as a sixth pillar. But this has not been the case among legal scholars over the centuries.
So one of the misconceptions, possibly, it sounds like, Emil, is that this jihad was that, you know, that everybody had to worship God according to the Quran and Muhammad.
No, that's not true.
Okay.
Only if you were a Muslim. If you were a Christian or a Jew, you didn't have to. You could follow your own laws. And if you live among Muslims, then you have to respect the Muslims' belief as well. And if the Muslims happen to rule that area, you have to respect their political power and laws. But you have your own set of laws as, say, Christians. Like, for instance, you have a right to drink wine and eat pork.
Mm-hmm.
And you should marry among your own group. So that it's not, there's no forced conversion. Islam did not convert by the sword. That is a myth. In fact, as Islam expanded its empires in the 7th and 8th century, as long as you paid your taxes and followed the rule of law of state, you were fine and you did not have to change your religion as long as you were a monotheist. That's one of those old myths.
I was going to say. So we're, in essence, we're talking about the same God.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I think that's important for our listeners to understand. Sure. I think we get all excited sometimes when we hear some people, you know, just going off on what Islam and Muslims and so on and so forth, and we think that there's this whole different religion entirely, but it to me, from what you've said so far, is it sounds like it's kind of based on the same premise, but they kind of, you know, they kind of came to a fork in the road, and one went one way and one went another way a little bit.
It's true. It's quite comparable. Where it differs from Judaism and Christianity are on two major points. For Muslims, the idea that Jesus is the Son of God is unacceptable because they take it literally. You know how in the myths, the Greek myth, Zeus sleeps with multiple women and gives birth to the women give birth to Hercules and the heroes. That's the way the Quran sees the idea of Jesus and Mary, that God sleeps with Mary. And they say, no, that's not possible. Though Jesus is a respected prophet, he is not the Son of God. As for the Jews, they said, you know, every human being has a covenant with God, not just a single people, as the Jews claim that it's their covenant.
Okay.
No, everyone has a covenant. So those are two differences that we see. But for the most part, much of this is very similar as a monotheistic tradition in the West. I think part of the problem sometimes happens is when people say, well, you know, Jews and Christians worship God, but Muslims worship Allah. Allah is just the Arabic word for God, and Christians in Egypt, whom I know, they use the word Allah when they speak of God because it's Arabic. When we speak in English, we just say it's God, and that's that.
Okay, I think that's an important point.
One of the other things you may be interested in, too, is besides the Quran, the other important source for instance, Muslim law is what is called hadith. Now, what a hadith is, it's a saying of something Muhammad said or did. And this these are collected over time in an oral tradition and becomes very important for understanding matters of law and ritual. So, for instance, the Quran says you're supposed to pray, that the traditions of Muhammad, the Hadith, say that you're supposed to pray five times a day and how you're supposed to pray. Now, in the Hadith is a saying that is quite controversial, that Muhammad, around the time, just before he died, appointed his son-in-law and cousin, Ali, to be the commander of the faithful. That is, to be his successor. Now, many people, most Muslims over time, have disagreed and said that's not a true tradition. However, and they instead say they follow the custom of Muhammad. The word for custom is sunnah. Therefore, those who follow what Muhammad said and did are Sunni Muslims. But those who believe that Ali should have led the community after Muhammad died are his partisans. And the word for partisan in Arabic is Shia. So those who believe that after Muhammad died, Ali and his direct descendants should lead the community are the Shi'i, whereas those who disagreed and said we should elect our new leader, they are the Sunnis. So that's your initial split between Sunnis.
Okay, so let me review this a little bit. You're kind of fading in and out a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So if we, the Sunnis believe, and the Sunnis believe that the leaders should be elected or chosen by the members.
By the members of the community, male members usually, yes.
And the Shiites feel that it should be following more like a monarchy where it goes down through the generations.
It's inherited, yes.
Inherited,
inherited,
okay.
Through the sons, yes.
Okay.
And so that's your initial difference. And over time, among the Shi'i, they have their differences of opinion about which son should inherit and so forth, so that among Shia today, or Shiites, however you want to use the term, we have differences, so that the Shi'i in Iran are not the same as the Houthi Shi'i in the Yemen, for instance. Nor are they the same as the Alawite Shi'is of Syria. A comparable case would be like denominations of Protestants.
Okay.
Southern Baptists are not the same as Methodists, who are not the same as Mennonites. They have certain things in common, but they have differences among themselves, too.
So this split came about almost immediately after the death of Muhammad.
Yes, yes.
And that,
certainly within the first 20 years.
Because when I was doing a little research on this, I'm finding out that there were assassinations and coups and
absolutely
all kinds of things that occur when there's a change in leadership sometimes.
There's a change in leadership and when a lot of power is at stake, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, a lot of power. I mean, considering that the Muslims controlled most of at least the Middle East and Northern Africa up into Spain.
They did indeed, as early as the 8th century. That's correct, as the empire spread, and they were quite successful as an empire. Yes, indeed.
So tell me a little bit about we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left, Emil.
Okay.
I'm talking with Professor Emil Homerin of University of Rochester. He's professor of religion and chair of the department up there, and my now resident expert on Islam. How is the Middle East divided by the Sunni and Shia? Is it
okay?
Let's talk about that.
It has depended over the long stretch of Islamic history. For the most part, the region that we think of as the Middle East today or the Near East has been largely Sunni. There have been periods, say the 11th century, the 15th century, where you've had significant Shi'i empires. One of the most important probably came up in the 16th century, and that's in Iran. And that's why we have the Shi'i in Iran today. And for a while, this empire, known as the Safavids, ruled parts of Iraq. And that's why we have substantial Shi'i community in Iraq today. And Iraq splits along lines of Sunni and Shi'i. Over the centuries, it depends on the particular time, but a lot of times the difference between Sunni and Shi'i didn't matter all that much. And the Shi'i and Sunnis lived together and got along pretty well. But when it became a political issue, then you could sometimes have warfare and holy war or jihad or struggles against various empires in the region. In a sense, over the 20th century, these the issues between Sunni and Shi'i were not major. And in fact, we're hearing a lot about it now, but I think as your second guest will tell you, much of what we see is really a political in nature and plays itself out against the backdrop of religious difference. But religion may not be the most important factor that people always make it out to be. That there are other political realities, and border disputes and oil revenues and these kinds of issues that are oftentimes at the heart of these disputes.
Well, if we look at, you know, the big discussion later on in the program we're going to be looking at is Saudi Arabia and Iran. And of course, now Iran is Persian.
Iran is Persian in its background, so that they speak a different language, have a different, somewhat of a different history, though they've been very much a part of the Muslim world for centuries. And in the past, many Iranians spoke Arabic as well.
Okay.
But not today.
Not today.
The religious clerics will all know Arabic, yes.
All right. So, and that's one of the reasons. Can you explain a little bit about the government of Iran?
Sure. So because they follow the Shi'i tradition, they had their leaders called imams, who were descendants from Ali, the cousin of Muhammad. But that tradition stops, that the imams around the 9th century disappear. Why do they disappear? Well, usually they disappear. In some traditions we have, like the Aga Khan, we still have imams today. But for the most part, most Shi'i believed that their imam is in hiding and will come back at the end of time. Okay, it's messianic. We know
about
the Messiah in Christianity. The Shi'i have this notion too. And in the meantime, however, many of the religious elite or the clerics in Iran decided that in the absence of their imam or leader, they will take control of the government. What's interesting is Ayatollah Khomeini, you remember him?
Yes.
When he came to power, he said that one cleric, one Ayatollah, a senior cleric, could rule the country. The irony is, his model was not anything in Islam, but it was the papacy. So he was looking to Rome and thinking, maybe this would work for me. But other clerics in Iran didn't agree. So what we have now in Iran is an oligarchy or a theocracy, leaders of the clerics, who basically are trying to control the country, trying to determine who gets elected, who can run for office, and so forth. There is a lot of disputes among their groups, too, and their factions that we hear about at times. So they're not a single monolithic group that sometimes they're presented.
Okay, we're coming up against the clock now, Emil.
Sure.
We have about 3 minutes. Can you give us a brief definition of Shia law?
Well,
no,
Shia law, Sharia.
Sharia.
The Sharia. The Sharia is Islamic law, and the Sharia contains a number of elements. It contains what we would call civil law, right? Property rights.
Mm-hmm.
Criminal law, murder. Commercial law, can you charge interest? Personal matters, here's the difference. Your will, okay, but also religious ritual. Your prayer ritual, how you perform the pilgrimage. So it's very much like canon law that we would find in, say, Catholicism.
Okay.
So it contains a number of elements. For people in the United States who don't understand, especially the reactionary right in America, they believe that the Sharia means the imposition of Islamic rule. And for them it does. And in Saudi Arabia, it could be like a literal interpretation of the Quran. But for most Muslims, it's about your will. It's about how you pray. And for almost all Muslim countries Muslim majority countries in the world, they have various forms of law, and it's usually not religious law, and it's not based on the Quran or the Hadith and all of these traditions.
There's so much more that we need to talk about, Emil. So I'm hoping that at some point in the future I can get you to come back on and we can talk more about this interesting religion. You know, it's fascinating when you think about how many millions of people are Muslim.
About a billion right now.
About a billion, right?
Yeah.
And so we got to figure out how we're going to work together with this, you know, large population. So anyway, I want to thank you very much, Emil, for being on Veterans Radio. And I think it was most enlightening. I know I learned a lot, and I hope that our audience does the same.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We will be talking with Emil sometime in the near future. Again, that was Emil Homerin, and his professor at the University of Rochester, chair of the Department of Religion and Classics at the University of Rochester. You can go to our website, veteransradio.net, and in the little flyer there, you can find out more information about him. I found that to be very, very interesting, and I hope that you did too. When we come back after the news, we're going to be talking with Bing West, and Bing is going to be talking about the political goings-on in the Middle East and what we can look forward to, or what has occurred in the last year and what we can look forward to coming up in 2016. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Again, give us a call. If you have a question, do that. 734-822-1600. My name is Dale Thronberry, and we'll be right back after the news. And we're back on Veterans Radio and kind of going to part two of our study of the what's the difference between Sunni and Shiite Muslims and how does it affect what's happening in the Middle East today. And I'm pulling Bing West, our guest, away from the football game, and it looks like the Redskins are winning right now, an unusual score. But right now, I want to welcome our guest, Bing West. Bing has been a frequent guest on Veterans Radio. He's written 10 books about war and close in battles. He's a graduate of Georgetown, Princeton universities. In Vietnam, he was a member of their Marine Force Reconnaissance Team that initiated Operation Stingray, attacks behind enemy lines deep in the jungles. Know a little bit about that. He also understands high-level strategy. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan. He's chaired the United States Security Commissions on El Salvador, Morocco, Egypt, Jordan, Pakistan, South Korea, everywhere in the world, it sounds like. So now we're welcoming our expert back to Veterans Radio. Bing West, welcome back.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for giving us this time today. As I was saying, I was looking at the score.
No, really no. Don't.
I'll tell you. Okay,
I'm not looking until after I talk with you.
Okay. Things are good.
Then, no, Dale.
All right. The first half of the program, Bing, we were talking with Dr. Homerin about Islam, and he gave us a little background in the history of it and the divisions between Sunni and Shia. And so we're up to date on what that has to do from a religious standpoint. I asked you to be on the program today to talk about what you think has happened in the last year in the Middle East. Has it been good or has it been bad?
It's been terrible. The Sunni terrorists, the Islamists, when they are perceived as winning, touch something evil in people who are tend to be prone toward evil to begin with. And that causes people around the world to take actions to kill others in a homicidal way. So that is very bad, Dale, that it has spread like a virus. Some people are inclined that way, and this gives them motivation to go out and kill. And that far transcends just the Sunni Islamists. Touches others. At the same time, unfortunately, our president is absolutely determined, regardless of reality, to cut a deal with the Iranians. And the problem there is that Iran is a theocracy that hates us. And as they gain power in the Middle East, they see us, honestly, as the great Satan. So on both sides, in the last year, American interests have been set back.
Okay. So we've got this deal that's going on with Iran. Could you explain to our audience a little bit about what your perception of that deal was?
Well, the president has promised that there will be no more economic sanctions against Iran in return for them giving some vague pledges that they will not develop nuclear weapons. Well, no one believes that. Iran is going to develop nuclear weapons. And we have no way of inspecting. And the United Nations gave Iran a free pass and said, we don't know what they were doing in the past. Well, if you don't know what they're doing in the past, what makes you think you're going to know what they're doing in the future?
Right.
And at the same time, we're allowing them to go ahead and develop ballistic missiles. Now, why do you have a ballistic missile? You have a ballistic missile to put a nuclear warhead on it and then tell the United States of America, stay out of the Middle East. And this is a very serious long-term problem. It won't be tomorrow. It will be 5 or 10 years from now that some president will be sitting there and he'll be saying, thanks a lot, President Obama. Thanks a hell of a lot.
Okay. Yeah, I got a feeling sometimes a lot of presidents say that to their predecessors, some people.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if I were to stand back and say, are we better off today and is the world better off today than at any time since World War II, I'd say yes, and it's because of American power. So if you're any president, including President Obama, and you look back at all the presidents to FDR, you'd have to really say thank you for what you've done, because we're a richer country, we have more freedoms, we've given more back to the world. So, I think President Obama honestly is going in a different direction than other presidents have gone, but we're not going to know for about another 5 to 10 years.
Well, for some people, they've only got, another 10 months or so to go. So we'll see what happens. That should be very interesting this fall. I don't want to get into that right now. So we've got Iran, doing their sword rattling all over the place. And now that we have this whole thing going on in Syria. So what do we do about Syria?
Well, let's back off a minute, because the reason that you have ISIS, the reason you have these Islamists, is in 2008, President Bush had won the war. Whether he should have invaded in the first place is another story, but by 2008, he had won the war. Then he signed a deal with Prime Minister Maliki, the Iraqi Prime Minister, and a man who cannot be trusted. President Bush signed the deal saying, we'll withdraw our Americans by 2011. When 2011 came along, the military, the State Department, and the intelligence agencies all told President Obama, Mr. President, you have to leave some American troops there, because otherwise Maliki is going to oppress the Sunnis and he's going to start the war all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And President Obama said, no, I'm taking them all home. Once we got out of there, Maliki, with the help of the Iranians and the Shiites, oppressed the Sunnis. This gave the opportunity for the Islamists to start coming back in. But at the same time, in 2011, we had the Arab Spring, these spontaneous uprisings against the dictators throughout the Middle East. And there was a huge uprising against Assad in Syria. And President Obama said, Assad has to go. But then he did nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Then Assad used chemical weapons against his people, and President Obama said, that's a red line, that will not stand. And then President Obama lost his nerve and didn't do anything about it. So Syria has become an absolute basket case, with Assad killing the Sunnis killing the Shiites and the Alawites who were with Assad. It became a huge civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole place is a mess. Now, you say, what do we do? There are two ways that you can look at this, it seems to me. And the one way is to say, President Obama says we're at war, but he doesn't mean it. If you're at war, you say, I have to destroy that enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you believe the enemy is this existential enemy, that you have to kill him before he kills you, then you have to send troops in on the ground to do it. But we're so tired of fighting these half-baked wars for 15 years. President Obama has spent 8 years telling the American people we don't have to fight them, and he has no intentions of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So I do not see any president, I don't care who it is, that's going to come in and replace President Obama that's going to go to war with troops on the ground. You'd need about 100,000. I don't see, the support just isn't there. So we should stop talking about them an awful lot if we're not serious about doing away with them. And we're never going to do away with them completely by bombing. We all know that.
Right.
So you're going to have to gradually start working with the Sunni Arabs who now hate us because we went over to the Shiites in Iran. So the next president is stuck with a situation, Dale, that I don't think is going to change too much from what we see today, regardless of all the rhetoric you hear, with one exception. If we have another attack here in the United States that is severe,
mm-hmm.
and all bets are off.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with that. And I think we probably is, I forget who it was, Ted Cruz said something, wanted to know about if the sand glows in the dark kind of thing. And yeah, I think we would do that at that time. So we're talking with Bing West here on Veterans Radio. What about what just occurred in Saudi Arabia? Is this kind of a stick-in-the-eye thing?
Saudi Arabia has become so discouraged about America. Just we dithered, and then we told President Mubarak, who had been our staunch ally for 20 years, that he had to go in Egypt during the Arab Spring in 2011. Mm-hmm. And the Saudis looked at that, and they said, we could be next. So they don't trust us. And they have a new defense minister who's the son of the king, who's only 30 years of age. They're trying to find their way, Dale, but they don't have strong protectors. I think they went too far in executing all these people, but they're a little bit at sea. They don't think they can rely on us, and they no longer take our counsel.
Well, I noticed in doing a little research for today, and I was looking at how Saudi Arabia is set up. Is it, it's a monarchy, and it goes down through generations, and they're, what was it? I forget who the name of the one king was. Had 43 sons or something like that.
Yeah, Abdullah, right?
Yeah,
right. Yep.
And trying to figure out who's the boss. Is, all of this court intrigue, it belongs on HBO at some point, I'm sure.
Well, we don't know enough about the inside to really, do
no.
that. Do that.
No, but I'm just saying, it sounds like one of those.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's and they're all.
They're programmed.
All rich, they all had a lot of money, but now they're going to have less money because oil prices have gone down. Saudi Arabia has all kinds of problems.
Well, and they're doing something with Yemen too, isn't that?
Have to, because yeah. Think. I mean, Yemen to them is Mexico or Texas. It's right there, So they don't want the Shiites in Yemen attacking them across the border. So they have to win that war. That's how they look at that. They've always looked at Yemen as being some wild tribes that they had to keep. They had to keep down, otherwise they'd attack them.
I guess the eastern part of Saudi Arabia is Shia also. Is that
eastern? There are
out in the oil field.
Don't have a map, but over the phone. But the answer is basically yes. There are large pockets of Shiites inside Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia is always worried about Iran stirring them up.
So we've got a lot of people over there stirring up the pot.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
On a regular basis. I want you to hold on, Bing. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment here on Veterans Radio with Bing West trying to figure out what are we going to do next? I don't know. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio. You know that song. Yeah, we're back here on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with Bing West about what's going on in the Middle East and maybe what will be occurring in the next year or 5 years, it sounds like. My next question thing was, how does Russia fit into this equation?
Well, in two ways. First, Russia has a port in Latakia, Syria, on the Mediterranean. And it's a 24-hour day, 12 months out of the year, warm water port. They don't want to lose that foothold. That port's very critical to them in the Mediterranean. So there's a military strategic reason there. The second thing is that Assad is their client, and Russia is aligned with Iran in order to reduce our power. And Putin looks at this as a means of exerting his own Russian influence over the Middle East, and at the same time causing us to have to negotiate with him and therefore not be as hard on him about what he's doing in the Ukraine and other places, because he has this manipulation that he can play with us about playing a game of footsie that maybe I'll help you, maybe I won't, relative to Assad. So he's playing us.
Well, it's something that's been going on for about 50 or 75 years or so.
Well, yes, but now he has a much stronger position.
Yeah.
The beginning in 1973, Secretary of Defense Schlesinger and Secretary of State Kissinger, when Sadat's war was ended, we insisted that the Egyptians throw out the Russians. And Russia lost its foothold in the Middle East. And Syria under Assad the father, the son's now in charge, Syria under Assad the father was very careful about the Russians, and the Israelis were pretty tough on saying, you better keep those Russians out. That's all gone now. So Russia is in a stronger position now than it has been since 1973.
I don't know. Since the breakup of the Soviet Union, I was kind of just assumed that Putin is just trying to expand his influence, as you just said that he is, and, you know, because they want to kind of take their place back in the, you know, in the power struggle.
Correct. And yeah. It also enables him to have a card that he can play. He can say, you, the United States, are all screwed up and you need my help. And it's working because when Secretary of State Kerry holds any meetings about the Middle East, he now has to invite Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So Russia has gotten itself back in the game.
Jeez. All right. So what's next? What do you see is happening over the next year?
Oh, under President Obama, the absolute minimum. I mean, he just wants to get out of Dodge, period.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to say he brought us Cuba or something. He wants nothing to do with this, and he knows that he doesn't have any leverage unless he gets tough, and he doesn't want to get tough. So you're just going to see more of the same. The president has been very angry at his staff for the last 2 weeks, saying my staff have not explained my strategy properly, because I'm taking a lot of criticism and I shouldn't be taking it, because my strategy is the only sensible strategy. So you're going to see from the president, for the rest of the time he's the president, a big argument, which essence is saying no one can do it any better than what I'm doing now, but he isn't going to do anything more.
So you don't anticipate or see any troops on the ground anywhere in the Middle East in the next year?
Well, see, this is the...
I mean, they're on the ground now. We know that, but not many.
Probably, yeah. Our special forces, the answer is yes. We've had our special forces there, but you're not going to see, for instance, a brigade of Army or Marines moving in. You're not going to see that. Now, I'll tell you the one thing, though, that everyone should be aware of and keep a careful eye on. Several of the Republican candidates and Mrs. Clinton have been saying that we should have a no-fly zone and a safe zone for the refugees. I think that would be a disaster for the following reason. It sounds nice,
yes, it does.
But the minute you become responsible for a safe zone, you own it. You are now responsible, and guess what's going to happen? every refugee is going to flock there, and you're going to end up with 2 million to 4 million people for the next 15 years that feel the United States of America owes them, and they're going to be in these camps in the middle of Syria, and we're going to be responsible for them. Don't get into a war on the defense by halfway measures. Don't do that. Do not go in and say, I'm going to have a sanctuary and a safe haven, unless you have a plan and say, and in the end, I'm going to take the offensive and I'm going to win the war. But don't go on the defense, because we're going to end up with something that's just like Israel has with the West Bank. We're going to end up sitting there with all these refugees, and they'll be our responsibility.
And they're just going to be getting angrier and angrier.
Of course, and they'll have nowhere to go. I mean, it's one of those humanitarian instincts that strategically is wrong. And you're hearing it both from Mrs. Clinton, because she's trying to be tougher than President Obama, and you're hearing it from some of the Republican candidates. And I'm just saying to the audience, they better think it through, because I think it would be a disaster.
What do we do with all those people?
Well, no.
I'm not asking.
I do not want to become responsible for them.
No, I understand that. I mean,
the way you avoid refugees is you win the war.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But if we're unwilling to win the war, then these poor people are screwed. They really are. But unless you have a president who says, American public, we've screwed this up. I've screwed this up. Now I'm going to unscrew it. It's going to cost us some of our treasure, some of our young men. But we have many young men in the Marines and the paratroopers who will fight for us. And I think this Islamists are a scourge who intend to kill us, and therefore I'm going to destroy them. But if you don't say that, then don't get yourself halfway and say, I'm going to be responsible for the refugees.
No, we can't do that. Because I want to make a quick pivot here and go to Afghanistan. What's going to happen there, do you think?
Oh, boy.
It's another hot box.
Again, it just drives me crazy.
I'm sorry to get your blood pressure up.
I'm just so miffed at President Bush for saying we have to go to these countries and give them liberty and then be responsible for them and try to turn them into democracies, and then President Obama saying, I quit. You know, both presidents have done a terrible job, but where are we in Afghanistan? Again, we have a very weak central government. The Afghans don't know why they're fighting the Taliban. The Taliban have a sanctuary in Pakistan, 1,500 miles of sanctuary. It's not going to end well. And the only way you can avoid it ending in a large disaster for the United States is that you have to keep, I would say, 15,000 or more troops there. And we have the troops who are perfectly willing to fight. That's not the issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's whether we have the will to continue. I think that President Obama has been told by his military, sir, you pull them out the way you promised, and you're going to have another Vietnam 1975 where we're going off our embassy in helicopters, and it'll be on your head. So I think President Obama is going to keep a minimum number of troops, let's say about 10,000 there, and then turn to a successor and say, well, here you are. I'm sorry, dear.
I'm sorry I can't
be more optimistic, but boy, we've really gotten ourselves into
a
corner.
Well, I mean, we've been doing this for 40 years, it seems like.
Well, you know, not for 40 years. No, that's not fair. No, I would say that this started after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Okay, so early 90s, right?
Correct. Correct. We began to overstep a little bit in the 90s, but it really started with 9/11. What started earlier than that, when we didn't take Osama bin Laden seriously earlier and get rid of him. But then President Bush overstepped when he said, we're going to bring freedom and democracy to Iraq and Afghanistan.
It's like they're going to, it'd be like them coming in here and saying, we're going to, make you a theocracy or something like that.
Correct.
We would never tolerate
Can you
tolerate
imagine somebody coming into us and saying, I'm going to convert you all into Muslims. Your women are going to become second-class citizens, and I'm going to put religion ahead of the Constitution. We would have said, you're out of your mind. But we went over to them with their religion they believe they keep their women in terrible condition. They say that basically the religion counts for more than the state. They're not secular. They're highly sectarian. And we said we can convert you in the course of 10 years to become Democrats and Republicans. It was insanity, but we tried.
Are there any similarities with the getting out of Vietnam and where you think that we might be trying to get out of any of these places? We're just going to leave a mess?
Well, but the difference, the answer is yes and no. Yes, mm-hmm. There are huge similarities because, look, we just walked away from Vietnam.
I know.
Oh, we did. We just flat out quit. Mm-hmm. But Vietnam was a small country in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
So there weren't reverberations when we quit.
Right.
There would be severe reverberations if the United States just pulled out of the Middle East, because there would be a chaotic, large-scale war, and, you can't predict how that would end.
No, that's true. That's true. One last comment, and I don't know if this has anything to do with your expertise or not, is what's been going on over in North Korea.
Well, the danger of North Korea, to a large extent, is that regime is wacky. I mean, and they have nuclear weapons.
That's, yes.
That is one hell of a dangerous combustible. And if I were basically the president, I would have gone to President Xi, the president of China, and said, look, you say you're a tough guy. I'm telling you. This situation in North Korea, with them having nuclear weapons, sooner or later has about a 50% chance that they're going to do something and use one of those damn things. And you know as well as I that the winds will blow that toward China. Mm-hmm. And if North Korea decays, the North Koreans will rush into China and you will have the refugee problem. Now, I'm not telling you how to solve it. But I think you Chinese know, if you really wanted to change that regime over 5 or 10 years, you could change it from the inside. And I just look them right in the eye and say, that problem is something that you Chinese know how to handle, and you could do it by gradually just undermining those wackos and getting reasonable people in there.
Well, as usual, Bing, I love your opinions. I love your thought process, and I love your projections in there, although it is very upsetting. Thanks very much for being on Veterans Radio. Go back and enjoy the rest of the
game. I will, Dale. Thanks a lot.
And
bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Well, folks, we got another one in the can, as they say. We've learned a little bit about Islam. We've learned a lot about what's going on in the Middle East. Don't hold your breath. I'm afraid we're all getting very nervous about what's going to happen. Tune in next week. We got another great program for you. My name is Dale Thronberry, and you are dismissed.